400 megahertz fast scan amateur television. It only puts out, I believe, 15 milliwatts. So we're going to have to run it into a, it's a driver. We're going to have to run it into an output module to develop 10 watts. I'd like to see how much interest there is in Weimark in putting up an ATV repeater, which I'd like to construct for the club, and help people in building these mini kits transmitters. I estimate to build the whole system up as a home system would cost about $300 for a member to get going with 10 watts of amateur TV. I was on back in the 70s. In those days, it was very expensive and very difficult to get going. They used 440 in those days. Had to modify a taxi cab radio. I had to buy a used television camera, which is very expensive, and even though it was used, I was glad to get it. It was only black and white. Today you could buy a color camera, surveillance camera, for about $30. You don't have to modify anything for reception. What we need to use, is one of these television dongles. They make a computer receive normal cable channels, but the cable channels coincide with the 400 and the 1200 megahertz amateur bands. So all you have to do is tune in the frequency of the proposed channel we're going to use. And you probably need a preamp at the antenna, because these dongles have god-awful sensitivity. So the whole transmitter would cost about $300-some-odd, a little more because we have to add a 10-watt module to it, what they call a brick amplifier. And I would be very happy to build a repeater out of those modules for Weimark, if we can get the interest. So I'd like to know if there's anybody interested. By the way, years ago in the 70s, Dick, you remember, you ran the Amateur Television and Technical Group. I'm here to reset. Ed Pillar, W2KBQ, with calls now. I'm on the Weimark 449 125 repeater. Ed was an excellent engineer. He designed a 440 repeater for Weimark, and at that time it was in a 6-foot-high rack. That's no longer necessary. Solid state, it's small, it's not tubed, it's very inexpensive. To give you an idea, there were two guys out there, one I remember, his name was Joe Sprotty, WV2AQM. Joe had a nice system going, one of the nicest systems. I think he was in, you remember that quick, where Joe was? And then there was a guy in Malvern named Joe. I think he's called, I forget his Joe's call. He was in Malvern. And he always used to call himself the Emperor of Malvern. And he put on a funny hat. That's why he called himself the Emperor of Malvern. You can show things. You can make stories up about your ham equipment. You can get as creative if you want, as you want. Some people will even take very small transmitters and they launch them on helium balloons. So maybe you can add something, Dick. I'd like to see if any members have an interest. I'll build the repeater. We need the funds. And I'd be glad to help members. They have to stuff the boards with parts, but if anyone has trouble, they can come over here and I'll help them out on a one-to-one basis. Back to that, I'd like to know if we have interest. If you're not interested, let us know that too.
Comment, Dick?
Go right ahead, John.
Dick, I think the proper place for this would be for Richie to make up a little statement what he's talking about and post it on the Limark website. He'll get probably more response. And, you know, he might find somebody who's interested. Here, I think he's more limited. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, you... Murphy's Law dictates that the guy who's interested in amateur television might not be listening to the TechNet tonight. Amateur television on Long Island did have an interesting history. Ed Pillar, W2KPQ, ran something starting in 1975 called the Amateur Television and Technical Net. I used to make contributions to that, sign in periodically, and I also were receiving amateur television pictures from quite a few of the hams on Long Island. And for a period of time, they had a repeater on a tower on Northwoods Road. Anyhow, just west of Huntington, I can't think of the name of the town, where there was this 300-foot high tower, and he had permission to put the amateur television repeater there. Amateur television in Long Island. The guy who has done it for the most number of years is Mike Cirillo, W2OTA in Massapequa. So Mike has been into amateur television for like 45 or 50 years continuously. He used to have also a silent key now, Uncle Willie, W2UWC, Uncle Willie Charlie in Hempstead. He was into amateur television. Joe Raspanti, who is both a, let me drop. Joe Raspanti was heavy into radio control model airplanes as well as amateur television. V2AQM, I think, was his call letters. So we've had quite a bit of history of amateur television. Andy, W2CDL, is into amateur television from time to time, recently. If you really want to do something well with it, it would sure would be nice to have a repeater mounted on a nice high tower and or balloon borne. If you go to the right website, I don't know that website yet, there are a group of guys in California for the last few years who have been flying helium-filled balloons with amateur television on board. And these helium balloons go up to almost 100,000 feet, showing pictures all the way. And quite often what they'll do is they'll take their best sponsor. Let me drop it. They take their best sponsor, make up a plaque advertising that sponsor, put it in front of the camera on a great big long rod as a kind of a selfie picture. So you see the sponsor's plaque in the middle of the picture, and you see, Eric, you want to talk to us? Maybe not. Okay, you'll see the sponsor's picture in the middle, his plaque, with the Earth curvature being viewed in the background from nearly 100,000 feet. And so by way of GPS and whatever, they track these things. The balloon bursts at 100,000 feet. It comes down with a parachute and amateur television all the way. So the guys in California have been doing that now for a number of years, quite successful. Both high school groups and college groups are doing it, from what I can tell. So I'm going to pass it over to the group. If there's anyone who we picked up tonight who thinks we should go further with amateur television. And by the way, Rich is proposing, I'm reasonably sure, is analog amateur television, not digital. The good news is that almost all of our television receivers will also receive analog television. So, we all own a receiver for this, if you know what I mean, just by going to the right cable TV channel and connecting an antenna, maybe with a preamplifier. So, do we have any interest tonight? Anyone want to throw the hat in the ring saying, yes, I want to go forward with this? Give me your call letters right now if you believe you're an amateur television enthusiast. K2RIW listening. And I think John had a good suggestion for you, Rich. By way of the written information, you can distribute through ARRL and through Limark. you can now get to more of the members, particularly through the monthly journal. So tonight, when it comes to Limoth members, we only have a certain percentage of them that are listening to the TechNet at this time. By way of the Limoth log, in theory, you can talk to all of them. Back to you for any comments on all of the above, Rich. N2EO, the amateur television enthusiast, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, take N2EO. Well, I will do that. Rich W, K2KN, Rich already suggested that I write something up for the log. But I figured in addition, I try asking here. Dick, you remember, it's a lot of fun. It's very creative because you build the stuff. It's not hard to build today. Not like years ago. And not like years ago, it's not expensive.
Yeah, there was an amateur, I can't think of his call letters now, a K2 call, living in Amityville, who was very heavy into amateur television in the early 70s. And his house was right on the Great South Bay. And so once every few years, his street would become flooded when there was high water. And I can remember one of his amateur television programs, which he recorded on videotape and played it over the air. You would see people using rowboats going up and down his street. And he bent the rules a little bit and played music in the background, surfing USA, while showing what it was like on amateur television. So, there's a certain kind of personal contact you can have with amateur television. It's a lot more than just listening to a person's audio. People like Mike, W2OTA, quite often has a great big poster that he puts up, which is a Hawaii scene, and he sits in front of the camera with his Hawaiian shirt, and he also has special effect television generators where he can do split screen and graphics generation and things like that. Let me drop it. So if you like technology, you can get pretty deep into it with amateur television. The one thing you got to worry about is that fast scan television, by definition, the receiver is roughly 4 megahertz wide, whereas the receiver you're listening to right now to listen to this repeater is only 15 kilohertz wide. That makes a huge difference in sensitivity. So unless you're running fairly high power, unless you've got direct line of sight to the amateur television repeater, the amateur television transmitter, your range on amateur television is quite a bit less than it is with audio, with FM audio. And FM audio is quite a bit less than single sideband audio. So you got to worry about the fact that if you think you're going to make a DX contact, 50 miles with amateur television, except for a band opening or except for a repeater mounted on the Empire State Building, so to speak, that doesn't necessarily happen. So it tends to be a lot shorter in range, but a lot more fun. And Andy, if he was available, would tell us some. I believe he's done some amateur television transmitting from each of the field day sites of Limoch. I wonder if Andy is on frequency tonight. The B2CDL. Are you there, Andy? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Golf X-Ray Mike with a question.
Okay. Golf X-Ray Mike. Go ahead, Rich. And make sure you give us as much audio as you can because your audio is very low.
I will try, Dick. I'm still using the HTs, but hopefully I will change that soon. What you're describing is broadcasting. Can you do broadcasting with amateur television, or does it have to be two-way communication, WB2GSM?
The way the FCC words it, if you're above 440 megacycles transmitting amateur television, they don't get into the fine details as to whether or not it's two-way or one-way and whether or not you're doing broadcasting, monocasting, bicasting, whatever. To my knowledge, nobody has ever had any problem with that. If you're following all of the FCC rules for below 30 megacycles, yes, you appear to be violating some rules. But above 440 megacycles, it's a victimless crime. So you're not allowed to transmit music. or if you're transmitting music with Yagi antennas aimed between point A and point B. I mean, he in Amityville was aiming his Yagi at me in Huntington and transmitting the signal to me on 439 megacycles. So he was not jamming anybody. He was not taking up too much bandwidth. I mean, nobody was using 439 megacycles in 1971, 72. So if it was a crime, it's a victimless crime. So technically, if you happen not to be... most of these guys, each one of them will transmit for a while and then go silent and go to the receive mode, and the other guy transmits. So most of the amateur television on Long Island has been two-way. Occasionally, it is one-way. Technically, it's broadcasting. But I think the chances of the Friendly Candy Company giving you a lot of flack on that above 440 megacycles is pretty low in risk factor as I see it, Rich. WB2GXM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. In closing, by the way, that board I was telling you about earlier is from PIEX, P-I-E-X-X. That's PIEX.com. That's for the IC 751, 751A, and the 71A receiver. It works very well. It's only $69.
And I think you're telling us, Rich, that you have bought, or somebody you know has bought that board, and they're happy with it. Is that true?
Oh, yes. I actually have all three units, the 751, 751A, and the 71A. And I'm well aware of the memory problem. PIEX is a great board. I also have one Wilco. I haven't tried it yet, but I think Wilco isn't making them anymore.
So I think those 751A and 71, I believe those are ICOM rigs. And I think during that period of time, there may have also been a Yaesu and Kenwood that had this dynamic memory. Is that true, Rich? The B2GXM, K2RIW, and I think that was in the middle 70s when that was happening.
I only know about the ICOMs. I don't know about the ASU or the others, but it stands to reason that's the same way. 70s is about the right time period. I don't want to go off topic with this. I just wanted to fill in from before. Thank you, Dick, WB2GXM.
Well, that's good information, Rich, and I'm glad you brought it to our attention. Now, there was another person who wanted to add some comments. Right now, the main subject on the table is amateur television. Was there someone else that wanted to make a comment? Give us your call letters and your name slowly so we can get it this time. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Jeff.
Go right ahead, Eric.
Anybody that wants to operate HTV on UHF, it's going to have a lot of issues because there's a lot of stuff in the portion of the band where you use HTV. Anyway, I'm setting this thing off for a minute, so it's going to go away for a second, and it'll come back in about another minute or two.
Yeah, Eric, you're getting some very high feedback squeals, which I know that your high-frequency notes don't get into your ears, so you may not know it. So we can barely understand your audio because of all the feedback. But I know you're gonna take us off the air for.
Hold on now.
Now's okay. So I know you're gonna take us off the air for a couple of minutes. Go right ahead with your testing of that Empire. K2RIW, KE2EJ, you got it.
All right, thanks, Dick. KE2EJ. K2J. Listen to 375. Are you hear me?
Yes, I am hearing myself on 375 with no delay. Sounds beautiful, Eric. Go ahead.
I think the audio is a little bit loud coming out of 375, isn't that?
That's true. Your audio and my audio seem to be 3 or 4 dB louder on 375 than they are at E5. Go ahead.
I don't know if I can. Yeah, I can adjust it from over here. Go ahead. Go back to what you're doing, and I'll interrupt you again.
Is there a way of adjusting the audio in 375? Is that gain control set too high on the link, or is it 375 itself a receiver of that link? Over to you, Eric.
It's actually probably the receiver of the link, which I can
I don't remember whether I have it hooked up or not. Let me look. I'll let you know in a minute.
I think John is able to hear the link itself, and he could tell us if the audio is high. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
The link according to my GDH meter is just right.
Okay, so we don't need John's info. So therefore, it's the 375 receiver out in Selden that said hi. I'll stand by and wait for you to hand us back to the net. Over to you, Eric.
Go ahead. Go back to the net. If I need you, I'll let you know.
Roger. Okay, we've gone down the list of everybody who signed in, who had a question. So it's time to go over to the mailbag. And we try to shoot for 9 o'clock doing that. And we're 9:26. We're almost on schedule, particularly since the repairs are going on. So what kind of deep questions have we had this week, John? And are they going to stump us again? And the people who send us questions, the real good ham radio questions that stump us, you and your lady friend get a dinner at a fine restaurant in Richmond County, supplied by John. I'm having some fun with him. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Yes, except they're all closed, Dick. Good evening, Dick. Everyone on the net as KC2WGB with the mailbag. All right, let me let it drop. I'll go on to my first one. Okay, this amateur, this is a good question. He has an antenna that's used in an automobile. It's a window mount, so it has a coupling unit to go through the glass, as you know. It's 2 meters. His question is, will that antenna work on a thin aluminum panel? Would it be transparent for the RF? What do you think on that, Dick?
Yeah, there's a number of variables involved here. The way the through-the-window antenna works is that there's a piece of coaxial cable coming right up to the launching circuit at the window frame. The shield of the coax cable goes to the metal of the car. The center conductor of the antenna through the glass structure goes to a small metal plate that's acting like a capacitor. On the other side of the glass, on the outside, there is a capacitor, another metal plate that goes to the radiator that's outside. And I don't think there is another ground on the outside. I think the outside doesn't require a ground. But the inside does require a ground. You're literally launching a signal, as far as the transmitter is concerned, you're launching a signal between the radiator that's on the outside of the glass with reference to the metal frame of the rest of the car. So as you can see, the rest of the car is the counterpoise. The capacitively coupled through the glass radiator on the outside becomes the antenna. Let me drop.
It's DPZ with a comment.
Dick, by the way, the aluminum panel is isolated from the chassis, just so you know.
Okay, yeah, let's get some more words now. He wants to use a metal plate instead of the window, and is he doing this in an automobile? You haven't described the location, John. Go ahead, John.
Dick, it sounds like he's going to use it in an automobile, but I'm not sure. So I don't think it matters. Let's say he had a window and he removed the glass and he put an aluminum panel, a very thin aluminum panel there. Do you think it would work in that case? Or try both the situations.
There's DPZ with a comment.
Hal recognized. Stand by, Hal. We still haven't got a definition of the problem here. The through-the-glass antenna is tuned for the amount of series capacitance you get through the glass. If you eliminate that through-the-glass capacitance, the glass itself is, let me pick a number, 3/16 of an inch thick, and there's a metal plate on the outside, a metal plate on the inside, that represents a certain amount of series capacitance. I don't know the number, but maybe it's 100 picofarad. That antenna is tuned for having a series 100 picofarad capacitor. If you do anything other than establishing that capacitor with the glass, you've now got a different tuning of that antenna. This is not serious. You can find ways of retuning the antenna. But your highest priority in any antenna is it must be resonant. You resonate first, then it will radiate. So you eliminate that series capacitor, there's a 98% chance you have knocked it out of resonance. You brought it down to a lower frequency. And unless you do something with that radiator, it is not resonant. It's going to give you a fairly high standing wave ratio from the description you've given us so far. Maybe I've jumped into the wrong description there, John. KC2WGB for some correction. K2IW in the second hand.
No, you've got it exactly right, Dick. That's what he's trying to do. And he's wondering, he hasn't tried it yet, so he's wondering if it's at all possible that it could work. Now, if it's just a question of adding some inductance or some capacitance, that's doable. But he was just wondering if it would couple through the aluminum plate. Or would the aluminum plate, even though it's not grounded, could that cause a problem?
Do you have a guess as to how big is the aluminum plate? Is it about the same size as the structure that goes against the glass on the inside? How did he choose that aluminum plate? Why is he using an aluminum plate instead of glass? And how big is that plate? Over to you, John.
It's a 32nd of an inch in thickness, and it's 16 by 16 inches.
Wow. The structure that goes on the inside of the glass is nowhere near that big. So he's got a brand new antenna. Let's see what Hal says about this. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, K6DPZ. First of all, I'm very familiar with fiberglass antennas. But let me explain something. Fiberglass antenna, a lot of them are a half wavelength antenna. And what they do, being it's a half wavelength antenna, the part that's behind the glass is a resonant circuit that's tapped up with a 50 ohm impedance, a little slug tune coil. It's coupled to the half wave antenna on the other side of the glass. Now, being it's a half wave, it has its own counterpoint. That's how a lot of the through the glass antennas work there. Go ahead.
Now, when you feed the outer edge of a dipole, which is a perfectly valid and a very effective way of feeding it in many cases, you're feeding 1,500 ohms instead of 50 ohms if you fed the center, or 70 ohms. So as long as that coil that Hal described, that's the resonator-like thing that's in the base on the inside of the car right at the window, that is an impedance step-up device that takes the 50 ohms on the cable, steps it up to roughly 1,500. The capacitor going through the windshield, maybe it has a capacitive reactance of 100 ohms. Well, 100 ohms of capacitive reactance when it's feeding a outer edge of a half-wave radiator, that's 1,500 ohms. That's nothing, if you know what I mean. You're spitting in the ocean. When you're feeding 1,500 ohms and you add an extra 100 ohms of series reactance, in my crazy example, you haven't done anything. Nothing bad happens. So now if you're substituting a metal plate 16 by 16 inches, I don't think that's the same antenna. If you're now trying to feed the outer end of a radiator that's 1,500 ohms, and you're trying to feed it through a 16 by 16 piece of metal, that's a brand new structure. If that piece of metal is only a couple of inches, I think you could make it work. 16 by 16 is way too big. He's creating a kind of a counterpoise in an area that you want to have maximum voltage. When you feed the outer edge, let me drop it. When you feed the outer tip of a half-wave dipole, you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance, usually resonant, and it takes very little series capacitance if you want to do it without direct connection. He could do it with direct connection. The circuit that touches the piece of metal that's glued to the inside of the windshield, if he took that lead and connected it directly to the radiator, I think it would work like a charm. And the shield still has to go to the frame of the car. The frame of the car is still the counterpoise. The good news about feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance is that a very small counterpoise would be sufficient. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech net.
You don't need any counterpoise at all. It's a halfway length antenna.
It takes very little. Hal says none at all. I say very little. Somewhere between the two is the truth. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Well, the only other thing I could think of, Dick, and maybe you have an objection to it, would be if he could cut a port It looks like from the measurements I can take here, it's about a 2-inch by 3-inch port where that structure couples. If he cut that out, it would still be watertight. It would be opaque. I don't know if that'll help him, but what do you think? Would that be beneficial?
You use the word port. You've got a beautiful mental picture in your head of what you're describing. The words didn't convey it to me, John, so the word port. I think by that you mean the structure that's inside the car, where the shield goes to the metal frame near the perimeter of the window. The hot lead, after 1,500 ohms of step-up, goes to the thing that's glued to the inside of the window, that's one plate of a capacitor. On the outside of the window, the automobile glass, is the another small plate that's the tip of the radiator. And so the word port and whatever you're describing in hole, you have to give me some more words, John. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
AC2WGB. Port, an opening. So if he cut a hole, a rectangle, 2 by 3 inches, and the flange on the inside would mount perfectly, so would the outside one, and there would be an airspace there, which he could adjust the airspace also. Do you think that would be beneficial? That's the only thing I could think of.
Okay, there's a lot of missing words here. Is he trying to use a through-the-glass antenna on the side of the metal panel of a automobile? Maybe it's a panel truck. Is he trying to establish a through-the-glass antenna in a place of the automobile where it's all metal and there isn't glass? That information, if that's what's going on, hasn't been given to us yet. John, go ahead.
Well, as I stated before, I'm not sure he's restricting this only for a vehicle. This could be a window. That he didn't tell me. But if it was like the side panel of a van, well, if he cut a port in it and still coupled it up, that would be better than trying to, well, that's not even aluminum. That would be steel. But he could still port that.
If he's mounting a antenna to the metal side of a van, for instance, the metal wall, there's a zillion antennas you can put there. I wouldn't try to force a through-the-glass antenna to operate in that environment. I would put another kind of classic antenna there. Let's see what Eric's got to say. Over to you, Eric. Yeah, lots of feedback, Eric.
Yeah, I know. Too many radios on. I'm going to shut it off for about another minute, and I should be done.
Okay, go ahead and shut it off. We'll stand by.
Okay, Dick.
Okay, sounds like we're back in operation. So if you're mounting an antenna on a chunk of steel, whether it be the roof of the car or the steel on the side of the car, there's a zillion antennas that work through the steel. To try to adapt an antenna that's made to go through glass and use it to go through steel instead, you can do it. I don't recommend it. If you have an antenna that's designed to go through steel, and if the chunk of steel you're going through happens to be vertical and you have to put a right angle connector on the radiator, or if it's the chunk of antenna going through steel is intended for the roof of an antenna, the roof of a car, a metallic roof, things get complicated if your car happens to be all fiberglass. If you try to put an antenna on a Corvette fiberglass body, life gets complicated. Doable, but you got to do different things. But to adapt a through-the-glass antenna where you're not going through glass and you're going through metal, I won't say it won't work, but I don't recommend it. There are much better antennas you should be using there, in my opinion. Some of them inexpensive and homebrew. KC2WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
It's DPZ with his comments.
John first, then we'll go back to Hal. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. All right, well, at least he should know that I don't think it's worth the effort. I'm sure he could find a way to do it, but I don't think it's worth all that work. So, I think he got a better idea. I wish he would have told me if it is for a vehicle or if this is for a metal replacing a piece of glass on a window, something like that. But he was dealing with aluminum. That's why he asked, because he knew that was a different type of structure than steel. But let's see what Hal has to add. KC2WGB.
You got it, Hal.
Well, the thing is, if he has a metal structure, put a feed through, use a three-quarter wavelength antenna, because the metal structure basically will be your counterpoise, it'll be a quarter wave driving a half wave, and it'll work beautifully on VHF. Now, I don't know what he's trying to do, but that's my best suggestion out of the box.
Yeah, the nicest kind of antenna is through the metal. Through the glass is a little bit more complicated. And people who have used through-the-glass antennas, if you tried to rate their performance, do you believe from your experience, Hal, that a through-the-glass antenna has full performance as a roof-mounted antenna, or is it possibly a dB a little lower? Because going through the glass gives you some other phenomena, particularly if that glass happens to contain a heater or if it contains a tinting. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
RIW-K6DPZ, through the glass antenna has a loss characteristic. Because remember, you're coupling, you know, a tuned circuit to a half wavelength device. So it's not going to be overly efficient. It'll work. You know, when you have no other choices, it will work. But it won't be something I would choose.
Oh, now phone call. Time to go to the next mailbag item, John. Over to you. Unless you want to add something to this, your choice. K2RIW.
KC2WGB. No, I think we've covered that. Very good. By the way, we got to thank you on an email this week. Last week, a gentleman was asking a question about a 1932 Roadster, a show car, and he followed our example, your recommendation. What he wound up doing, he used a half-wave whip. This is for 2 meters. He mounted a piece of three-quarter-inch steel about 4 inches long, 3 inches wide. He epoxied that Bondo or whatever, some kind of epoxy, underneath the deck lid supports, and that's where he sticks his magnetic coupled half wave. And it worked perfectly, and he has, when he takes it off, there's no indication that anything is different in the car. You really have to look to see this piece of metal inside, so he's very happy with that.
Gee, that sounds awfully good. Do you happen to know what brand name of mag mount half wave antenna he used? Or was that partially homebrew? How did he come up with a half wave radiator mag mount antenna? Over to you, John.
He bought a diamond antenna and he modified it a little bit. I think he changed the length slightly in tuning. Rather than add capacitors or inductors, he changed the length, and that seemed to satisfy the instrumentation, showing him that it was resonant, and he was doing very well with it. He's used it a couple of times, and he even used it at the show with photographs showing them how he did it, because other people that were interested in having communication antennas put on their cars without damaging the cars or their quality of their look. So he was very appreciative.
I presume he's going through something like a fiberglass roof. Do you happen to know what kind of a car? Was this like a Corvette? Go ahead.
1932 Deuce Coupe Ford. It's all, as I explained, it's all fiberglass. There's no metal rails, nothing, except some of the support brackets for shocks and things like that are made out of metal. Other than that, there's no metal in the car. And I don't know if you're familiar with car show stuff, but some of my friends that looked at this car said that the quality of the finish, what he did with this car, is excellent. And it's a quality that they don't see too often. So he's very proud of this car.
Okay, the one missing piece of information is this is a 1932, I'm guessing, reproduction. I don't think fiberglass as a construction material was popular in 1932. Is that true, John? Go ahead.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Dick. This is a car that you buy as a kit. and you buy a, you pick your engine, and you, they sell you the proper fiberglass elements to mount the engines and things like that. And so it's a kit car, comes in a box, and you glue it together, and then I think it costs $6,000 to paint it, Dick.
So from the outside, it looks like that classic 1932 car. And to try to find a company to give you those sheet metal stampings that they used in 1932 would be out of the question. But to reproduce that in fiberglass with proper painting on the outside, you can't tell the difference. Well done. Okay, sounds like he's a happy camper. And this is another one of those examples of the magic of a half-wave radiator. I mean, we all think our dipole's got to be fed in the center. Nothing magic about the center feeding the dipole. And there's a huge advantage in some cases of feeding the outer tip of a half-wave dipole radiator. As long as you can step up the impedance from 50 ohms to 1,500 ohms, it'll work like a charm. And if you're doing it at a... Let me drop... If you're doing it at a field day site, the counterpoise can be a simple stake in the ground, which would be more than enough conductivity when you're feeding 1,500 ohms. You would never get away with that with a quarter wave ground plane. You'd be pumping 98% of your power into the earth because you'd be pumping, you know, you'd have a few hundred ohms of ground resistance and you're feeding a 35 ohm antenna. And so almost all of your RF is going into the ground. But when you're feeding a 1,500 ohm tip impedance of a half-wave dipole, depending on how thin the dipole is, maybe the impedance could actually be 2,000, 2,500 ohms. So feeding that with the right step-up device, a simple L-network, one inductor, one capacitor, properly chosen, will do that step-up for you beautifully, as well as tuning it. If the capacitor or the inductor is variable, you can now tune it to the low end of the band, the high end of the band, and so on. And a simple stake in the ground is the counterpoise. And so for either a temporary setup at a field day site or even a permanent setup in your front yard is the way that, why can't I think of his call letters right now? You know the guy I'm talking about who had that in his front yard. Mel, K2KEY. K2KEY had a halfway dipole, a piece of green wire, stranded wire, vertically hung from the evergreen tree out in front of his house in Brooklyn, and it worked like a charm. Okay, go to the next one, John. KC2WGB, K2IW the Tech Man.
KC2WGB. By the way, Dick, the Pebble Beach Car Show is coming up the third week of August every year. What a magnificent show this is. These are all cars that are redone completely. And they, you know, can be $4 million, $10 million. These cars are just unbelievable. And this is the quality they told him he had. Of course, he can't compete because it's not a real car. It's something that's fake. But I will tell you this. All of those parts are available, some new old stock, in metal. If he wanted to build it out of metal, he could have done that. These guys are really crazy with these cars and the amount of money they spend. The people who looked at it to give him that judgment, they own a 1932 Bugatti, which had gone to Pebble Beach a couple of times, and that car's worth a few million bucks, and they told him what a marvelous job. So, yeah, he's a happy camper for sure.
I should know, where is Pebble Beach? Is that along the East Coast?
California. It's a golf course, and every year they have this show. You'll catch it on TV. They always show it. It's you look at those cars, and I don't know if you're into old cars, but you see cars that are just amazing from all over the world.
Did you ever have a chance to go to Pebble Beach, Sean? Sounds like you'd really enjoy it.
Yes, when I was out in California, I went there twice, and it's a real... It's like the Kentucky Derby of auto, of auto collectors. Jay Leno's there, all the big shots.
Roughly how many people go as a, who are submitting an entry? How many people go as a crowd? Sounds like a few thousand gather here. Go ahead. It sounds like it is the Dayton Hamvention of automobile enthusiasts. Go ahead.
I believe you're right, Dick. It is in the thousands, and the cars are in the hundreds, and they cover the full spectrum from little cars to the big old cars with those huge headlights, and if you see them, you just can't believe that they brought these things back to life. And they all run, they all work, and they are polished with like Q-tips. You just can't believe the kind of work that goes into it. But it's an experience for sure.
Is part of that competition what they call Concours d'Elegance, where they literally take a white glove and wipe various portions of the car as part of the competition?
Usually they're not allowed to touch the cars. They're very fussy about touching the cars. But yes, the judges can do whatever they want. They go under with mirrors, and they check for little oil leaks, and the white glove test, the hoses. I mean, they just go over the car with a fine tooth. The grading of the cars, it's all listed on a schedule, and it's very tight.
To keep the car that clean, I am guessing they put it in some kind of a fully enclosed van in order to transport it to the competition. I'm having the impression you wouldn't drive the car there for fear of it picking up some dirt. Over to you, John.
Oh, you're absolutely right. They have these enclosed box trailers. Most of them are trailers. Some of them are driving trucks, box trucks. But you pull up, there's a ramp. You drive up like you're going to go into the truck, but that ramp becomes an elevator. It lifts it up and stores it in the upper part of the truck, and on the lower part, they either have another car or they have the little workshop that they carry all their polishing tools and toothpicks and things like that.
And people think ham radio operators are crazy. There's multiple kinds of craziness in the United States for those who are affluent. Over to you, John.
Gee, that word affluent, I don't even know if that describes it. It's like sinful, Dick. They're wild. But you see all the women dressed up in their best, just like the Kentucky Derby, and sipping martinis or whatever. And they all have a lot of fun. All right, I'll let it drop, and I'll go on to my next one, sir.
WS2N for John.
Go ahead, Paul.
John, you might be aware of it. I assume you have cable. But MSNBC on Wednesday nights has a show with Jay Leno. It's called Jay Leno's Garage. And he covers new cars, but his main thing is a lot of the older cars. And it's been on, I think this is the second season. And it should be restarting again probably this fall. Right now it's off. Back to you, John.
It's on CNBC, not MSNBC.
Now 24, I know. It's on cable, isn't that MSNBC?
It's on CNBC, not MSNBC.
Oh, okay, yeah, it's more, whatever. Channel 24, I know. Back to you, John.
Yeah, you're right. Jay Leno is some collector. He has a huge garage. I actually saw his Stanley Steamer. Perfectly working like it just came out of the factory, and that was at a show, and what a magnificent job he did on that. So he's got some collection, millions and millions of dollars worth of cars, but they're like all collectors, they're crazy.
Very good, yeah, I'll catch that show. He does a very good job, plus, you know, he's still got his humor, but he was always a car collector. Dick, over to you.
And we amateurs with our thousands of dollars worth of radios and thousands of dollars worth of antennas and towers, we're not crazy. Isn't that true, John? Over to you, John.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we're not crazy. We're just slightly tilted that way. But the gentlemen I know that have a Bugatti, I think that's worth like $4 million. They restored it totally. And they also have, before that, they did a Corsair from World War II, and they have that in perfect condition. And I don't know how much that's worth, but it's probably priceless. But there's collectors for anything, Dick.
You got it, John. And by the way, I know people who collect test equipment. And when you look at their website at QRZ.com, wow. Where the hell, who in the world could afford that many pieces of test equipment in one location, at one address, if you know what I mean? Over to you, John.
Yeah, my
my friends told me they couldn't afford to plug them into the wall for the electric bill. So, yep. Okay, let me drop off. Go on to the next one. Okay, maybe you can help this young man out. He has an antenna that he put up, and he went to the Berkeley program to find out the corrector factors he's going to need. He got them, and he built these little kits. Now, his problem is, can he mount those in the shack at the transmitter, or do they have to be mounted up at the antenna at the end of the coax lead, Dick? What do you recommend?
Okay, Berkeley will tell you how to impedance match from point A to point B. The usual example of that is you've got a 50-ohm transmitter feeding, let's say, a 50-ohm coaxial cable, characteristic impedance, and the antenna itself, by some means, you discovered what is the impedance of the antenna. If you did it by measurement, you probably did it with either an antenna analyzer or a vector network analyzer, VNA. So a vector network analyzer or an antenna analyzer showed you the real impedance of the antenna. That's if you did it as an empirical, real measurement. If you know the dimensions of the antenna, the diameter of the wire, the length of it, and so on, if it's a wire antenna, by various means you can come up with an extremely good estimation of the impedance of the antenna. Okay. In the most ideal world, you'll take that measured or calculated impedance of antenna and what you believe is the impedance of your transmission line, 50 ohms in my example, and you go to Berkeley and say, give me a network that goes from point A to point B. That gives you the most ideal performance. Let me drop it. Now, if the impedance of the antenna is such that when it hangs on the end of a 50-ohm cable, it doesn't give you a fierce standing wave ratio. If it happens to be a 100-ohm antenna and is resonant, by definition, that's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio on a reasonable length of 50-ohm cable of reasonable performance, not a very lossy cable, you definitely have the ability, in that example, to do the impedance matching in the shack. However, if your antenna at your desired frequency happens to have, let me pick a number, 1,000 ohms of capacitive reactance, and even if it's a 50-ohm antenna as far as the resistive component is concerned, the fact that it's got 1,000 ohms of capacitive reactance means that, by definition, when you go to the formula, you take the impedance of the antenna. In my example, it would be open parenthesis 50, comma, minus J 1,000, closed parenthesis. That's the impedance of the antenna, Z of antenna, ZA. And if you take ZA minus 50 divided by ZA plus 50, and you carry out that complex division, then you take the absolute value of that. You have just calculated the reflection coefficient. And you take that reflection coefficient plus 1 and 1 minus that reflection coefficient, you now have standing wave ratio. You do that in my example. I don't know the exact number, but it probably is going to be something like a 30-to-1 standing wave ratio. Reactance builds up standing wave ratio real fast. So in that example I've just given you, let me drop it. A 30-to-1 standing wave ratio hung on the end of a 50-ohm cable would give you an amount of 50-ohm cable insertion loss that you probably wouldn't want to tolerate unless you're using inch and 5/8 Andrew Heliax dry nitrogen filled, if you know what I mean. And that stuff, by the way, is $10 a foot. Very, very low loss cable can tolerate extremely high visible. Any reasonable amount of cable feeding a 30-to-1 standing wave ratio is going to have a huge amount of loss unless it happens to be open wire line. 600-ohm open wire line, it could tolerate that, no problem. Any reasonable coax, no way. You do the impedance matching in the shack with 50-ohm coax on a 30-to-1 standing wave ratio, and you're going to have 10 dB of loss in your transmission line system. I'm rounding off the numbers, but you can see the principle. So, must you do the impedance matching in the shack or at the antenna? It depends. How bad is the calculated or measured standing wave ratio? If it's numbers like 3-to-1, you can do it in the shack. If it gets to numbers like 10-to-1 and above, you're going to start getting a hell of a lot of loss. So it pays your money, it takes your choice. Now, Now you know the criteria to make the decision as to where you do the impedance matching. In almost all cases, doing the impedance matching right at the antenna gives you the best. However, let me drop this. Mounting an impedance matching antenna out there, weatherproofing it, hanging it in the air at the antenna, it can be kind of inconvenient to mechanically protect it, to weather protect it, and so on. But in almost all cases, if you're willing to make the effort of doing the impedance matching in the at the antenna, you will, by definition, get the highest possible performance. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Well, I think his best bet, because the antenna is already up and wired, I think he should take the little adapters that he built and hook them up in the shack and then check with his metering and to see if it's going to fall in line. That's the way I think you should try it. If he has difficulty, then he could probably lock it up in a PVC tube or something and mount it up at the antenna. But I would try the easy one first. Okay, very good. Well, it gives him a direction anyway. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next one.
Yeah, stand by, John. There's another variable here. If I had a calculated 30-to-1 or measured 30-to-1 standing wave ratio at the antenna, by definition, I am forced to do the impedance matching at the antenna. You're going to get a huge amount of loss in your transmission line if you don't do that, because when you do the impedance matching at the antenna, the transmission line is now going to be running a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. It'll have minimum loss. You run the transmission line itself at 30-to-1 because you're doing the impedance matching in the shack. You're going to get a huge amount of loss. The signal is bouncing back and forth. Most of the signal is bouncing back and forth under lossy conditions in the cable when you're feeding a 30-to-1. But there's another catch. The calculated impedance matching device you put at the antenna is not the same device you put inside the shack for at least three reasons. Number one, a length of cable, which you can prove by way of a Smith chart and by way of calculation and so on, any length of cable of whatever impedance you're using is going to take the impedance of the antenna, rotate it to some other location on that Smith chart. If your antenna has a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, you can take a Smith chart and you draw a circle of the right diameter that represents 10-to-1 standing wave ratio. Now, as you change the length of that transmission line, you are literally walking along that circle as to what impedance you're going to see in the shack. Therefore, you're going to get this brand new impedance in the shack, and you have to include in that impedance calculation in the shack not only the fact you're walking along a 10-to-1 circle on the Smith chart, but the fact that the cable has loss. So as the cable becomes more and more lossy, the impedance you see in the shack becomes closer and closer to a 50-ohm load, if you know what I mean. It's not real, but you think you're feeding a 50-ohm antenna. So the impedance matching device, you don't just simply move.
Repeater, timeout.
You don't just simply take the impedance matching device at the antenna and move it into the shack. It's a brand new device, depending on length of cable. And the other disadvantage is that your length of transmission line changes in wavelength as you QSY. As you go from the low end of 80 meters to the high end of 80 meters, your length of transmission line is a brand new number of wavelengths. Therefore, even if the antenna itself didn't change in impedance, what you see in the shack is changing. So the wording we've used up till now, John, would lead you to believe that you just move it and decide where you're going to put it. Uh-uh. It's a brand new network of a brand new design when you put it inside the shack. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Very good. Understandable. I hope he returns and let me know how he makes out with this. I'd like to find out which way he goes and whether he was able to match it up in the shack itself. So, yeah, maybe I'll email him reply back with this, because it'd be nice to know how he makes out. I'm sure a lot of people go through this.
Many people forget about the fact that a length of transmission line is an impedance inverter, if it's a quarter wavelength long, It's an impedance transverter if it's any other length. And that's true only if, the only place where it's not true is if the antenna happens to be a 50-ohm load on the end of a 50-ohm transmission line. Now, any length of transmission line doesn't matter. That's the one case where it